Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Lots happening on the show this week as we kick things off with hot air balloon pilot Ken Roland. He tells us all about the ins and outs of ballooning and why going for a hot air balloon ride is a great gift idea. We then chat with lifestyle expert Christine Eisner about streamlining your home and putting to use old treasures that you may have kept stored away. We top it all off talking about over-the-counter drugs and how they can be useful in healing your pet with veterinarian Dr. Robert Ridgway. He's written an excellent book and gives us some wonderful tips and ideas to better care for your animal.
Capture your need for sound.
Father's Day is just around the corner, and if you're tired of always getting him the same old thing, our next guest has an idea that will blow you away. Literally. A balloon ride. A hot air balloon ride. Ken Roland owns Toronto Balloon Tours and has been a balloon pilot for 33 years. Ken, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
So, can you tell us why a hot air balloon ride is a good idea for Father's Day?
Well, for one thing, it is not a thrill ride. So Dad's going to just love this. It's mostly appreciated from the vista that you get, the excitement that these darn things can even fly at all, and the fact that they're so quiet. We'll go up to a couple of thousand feet, and it's just amazing just how quiet the balloon is and the vistas and the 360-degree horizon.
That's fantastic. And do you actually have customers that, you know, are afraid to go up? Is this, you know, the type of gift maybe where you should speak to that person in advance so that they're not nervous when they arrive and see themselves in front of a hot air balloon?
Well, you know, I've never had anyone refuse, but it's always something that I tell the people that are wanting to book this special gift for, let's say their dad, that, you know, if it's a surprise and they show up, they just might not get in this darn thing. So I do have them, you know, warm them up to the idea to get a little feel that it's something that they would like to do before they commit them. But like I say, I've never had anyone actually refuse to get up.
Now, I know you said previously that this is not a sport for thrill seekers, but it sounds like it could be something that's enjoyed by all walks of life and probably a large degree of people from being a kid right up to senior citizens.
I've flown people from as young as 5, my own son for that matter, to as old as 90. A lot of people use the term, well, there's another thing off my bucket list. The young fella I noticed, though, and when people call for young children, I recommend that they're older than 7 so that they can hang on, see over the edge of the basket, and basically not be bored after the first 10 minutes of flight. It's really mostly an adult activity. It is just that vista is what takes your breath away.
And can you explain to us, Ken, what you sort of see and hear when you're up that high? Because I know you keep mentioning this amazing scape, this landscape in front of you. But what's it actually like to be up there? Is it cold? Is it super windy? Do you just hear the noise of the tanks working?
Well, there's very few moving parts in a balloon. The sound that you will hear, and we try to throttle it right back so it doesn't bother you, is the sound of our pilot lights, which is like a little fire that you'll see on a gas stove that sits there always ready to go, so that when you put propane to your burners, you get that a blast sound. That is a sound, but it's not constant. It happens the higher you are, the less frequent it is as well. You will get a sensation in your ears from the height, because as we go up, well, the change in pressure and so on will affect your ears. You are in an open gondola, basically a basket. You have no wind on your face because the balloon travels with the wind, and you have no feeling of vertigo. I find that even myself, if I'm at a high place and I'm looking out over the edge, you get that leaning sensation, that feeling. You don't have that in a balloon. It's almost comforting in that basket, and yet your mind is still traveling around, looking up and seeing this great big huge envelope, which is the balloon part of the balloon above your head, and this wickered walled basket. It is sort of a conflict in your mind. You're not seeing this super rigid aircraft and nice, what looks so sturdy. You see this basket, but you have this calmness, this feeling of, I don't know, it's just it's very calming, I find.
Joining us on the show is hot air balloon pilot Ken Rowland. Make sure to check out his website, airdisplay.ca. Ken, can you explain to me, if we start off from the beginning, when you're on the ground, how long does it take you to get the balloon up and running?
Okay, well, we fly in two times during the day. There's no daytime flying in hot air balloons because of winds generated from thermals. The balloons themselves, there's no horizontal steering, so you're looking for a wind direction, and amazingly enough, the wind at different altitudes often go in different directions, sometimes 180 degrees. That's the opposite direction. The inflation part of the balloon in the morning, and that's at sunrise, so it's real morning we're talking about, is we're going from a very calm nighttime conditions into the daylight hours. So our inflation time then is maybe about 20 minutes to half an hour. Usually we stretch it out a little bit to walk people around the aircraft so they can get some of those interesting, neat Kodak opportunities, pictures down through the top of the balloon and so on. In the evening, it's a little opposite to that because we're waiting for the unsettled daytime conditions to calm down to allow us to inflate the balloon and then take off. So the evening does tend to be a little longer because we're humming and hawing and looking at the wind and waiting for the gusts to die off and begin the inflation. So often maybe half an hour to 40 minutes in the evening, but it's mostly a stall tactic, if you will. We're just waiting for the weather to calm down and keep everybody a little busy while we're doing that.
And what's your window, Ken, with regards to the morning and the evening flights? Like, is it a 3-hour window? Like, do you need to be, you know, between 6 and 9 and, you know, 6 and 9 again at night? Or how does that work?
Well, the evening one is pretty easy. We have to be on the ground before the sun sets. So the later that we have to wait for the daytime heating winds to settle down, the less length of time that we have to fly. In the morning, it's different because assuming, of course, everything is assuming this, that the weather is going to allow us to fly. It's a very weather-dependent sport, okay? In the morning, we begin our inflation, and the pilot is watching. When we're in the air, we're watching for these conditions to start to develop what's referred to as thermals, okay? We want to be on the ground before the thermals get too active and cause a hazard for the balloon.
And can you explain, I guess, weather patterns to us and the fact that, you know, you mentioned it's a very weather-dependent sport. So, you know, do you have to make sure that, you know, it is going to be a clear day for miles around?
Actually, no. Clearness, although, does really help with the view and the vista, because your aviation weather briefing does give you this, one of the components of it is what's referred to as visibility. And visibility could be affected by a number of things, including the dreaded smog. However, the clear, it does make it for a very nice flight when it's clear, but the clouds don't really affect how the balloon operates. The rain is definitely an issue with the balloon. So, I mean, if it's raining, the flight is off. And one of the biggest issues, particularly when you're dealing with rain, are thunderstorms. So we need to have those routes quite far away before, and we're talking like over 100 miles, quite far away before we would consider flying in that kind of activity. But in the end, the overall showstopper tends to be wind. So that wind from what's referred to as a gradient, it's like lines on a map with the different pressures can give you quite a bit wind, and we are limited to winds 7 knots or less.
Okay, and what's the actual season for ballooning? Is there a season? Is it just spring and summer? Like, how does that work too?
Well, we fly generally just for passenger comfort from between May and October. As we get near the end of October, we start to limit ourselves to just morning flights because sunset is so early, and actually sunrise becomes quite normal to everybody, so we meet out at like 8, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, which is what you would a comfortable time for people. Winter flying is very unique. It's a lot of fun, but where balloons land is out in fallow fields. That's fields without crop or livestock and things like that. Winter flying opens up a lot of landing space, so there's no crops and areas like small ponds and things like that are frozen, so you're able to get there. The trick about winter flying, besides the cold temperatures, is the fact that you land, you jump out of the basket, and you're up to your waist in snow.
Right.
So we have a huge toboggan to be able to pull the balloon out of the fields in for winter flying. However, we don't conduct winter flying for performing any passenger rides then.
Okay. And I actually wanted to ask you about that as well, you know, how you figure out the landing thing? Because I've always been fascinated thinking that you guys are at the mercy of the wind. So when you start at point A, do you have a good idea about where the point B landing is going to happen? Or can it vary within a couple of miles?
It can vary within a couple of miles, and some pilots are much better at this than others. Okay, the main thing is that you're going to pick up a place that's not going to damage anything and not scare any livestock. Farmers are very important to ballooning, and we want to make sure that landowners are happy and are inconvenienced as little as possible. The balloon lands on property is fine. And the truck, our chase crew, and that's something that should be noted here. We have a truck and chase crew that's following the balloon because it doesn't get back to where it starts from. It flies a one-way trip only. So we can pick our spots to land quite well. If we come upon a place that's not so good, we just fly on. If things get in our way, we fly over them and down. We don't have to go around them. One of my favorite spots generally in the summertime are rural roads that are less traveled, okay, and they make a nice landing spot for the balloon when there's no power lines and hazards like that around.
That's actually really cool, and I'm glad to know this because I've always wondered how it is where you guys figure out where you're landing. And as well, you know, speaking of the balloon itself and the basket and all that kind of stuff, when you see these balloon shows where there are, you know, multiple balloons up there that have varied designs and stuff, you know, you see cats, you see elephants, like all these kind of crazy designs that are up there, does that affect how you fly as well, the shape, if you are having, you know, sort of a theme balloon?
Oh, very much so. The special and that the kind of balloon that you're referring to are referred to in the industry as special shape balloons. Those beasts weigh a lot. So a balloon, how much it carries depends on the volume inside the envelope, okay, how much volume. The appendices, things that you see on the balloons, like noses and arms and squiggly things like that, are all weight which is added to the balloon but provide no lift to the balloon. So the big ones, they can weigh thousands of pounds. Okay, for a while there, I think we had a Canadian Mountie that was flying. We had a huge maple leaf. We've had a number of these special shaped, high entertainment value for people to watch them. A major chore for the crew, though. They are very, very heavy to move around and prepare to launch and then recover after a flight.
Wow, that's fascinating. On the show with us this week is hot air balloon pilot Ken Rowland. Check out his website, airdisplay.ca. Ken, when it comes to the mechanical part, I guess, of going up and down, can you explain that to us? I think you called it the pilot lights and stuff. What does that involve? And do you need like three of them in that balloon? Is it one? Like, I don't know how that works either.
Okay, well, depending upon the size of balloon, okay, the balloons come in a large array of sizes. And if we'll just talk about from the passenger point of view, you've got single passenger balloon up to balloons that can carry 24, 26 people. They're huge. Okay, now the balloons have three components. They have the envelope, which, like I mentioned earlier, is the balloon part of the balloon. And it's a very colorful thing that you see. It's the huge part. Then it also has the gondola, which is the wicker basket at the bottom, and sometimes they're partitioned so that there's little spaces in there for the pilot and the passengers and so on. And then you also have your burner fuel system, which for all intents and purposes can be called the engine of the balloon. Depending upon how big the balloon is, they could have a number of burners. Some have four burners. The balloons that I fly have two burners. So basically, you've got propane, which is your fuel system, goes to your burners, you heat, you ignite the propane and put this big torch-like flame inside the envelope, the balloon, and it heats up the air inside the balloon, and the balloon rises, because everybody knows hot air rises.
Right. I do know that. I remember that from class, from science class. I'm good, Ken. I'm good. That's fantastic. Now, when you are in operating the hot air and all that sort of stuff, how do you know, I guess, how much you need or don't need? Do you always fill your tanks, I guess, full is my real question in this?
Absolutely. After every flight, we fill the tanks. We wouldn't want to be jumping out there and finding tanks that are half empty on you and being challenged by having no fuel. That would certainly not be fun. You'll fly for about an hour. Okay, sometimes longer depending upon the maneuvers. If you go high and up and down, you'll burn a lot more fuel. Just think of it like a car. The But when you put your foot to the floor and you speed up, it's just like the balloon going higher. Okay.
Okay.
Higher the balloon goes, the more fuel it uses. And generally speaking, though, a nice passenger ride is about an hour. Sometimes it's a little longer because it's difficult to find a landing spot. And sometimes it's a little shorter because we're flying towards things like a lake, which we might not get across. So we want to be safely on the ground before we get stuck over something like that.
Now, I imagine in all these escapades that you've had over the last 33 years, I'm sure there's been some really interesting rides that you've gone on. What's been the craziest thing that's happened to you up in a balloon?
Well, you know, crazy isn't exactly the right word. Everything is slow in a balloon. One of the challenges, though, is to be mindful that when you are flying, and I tend to talk a lot with the passengers, and if you're not paying attention on the ground that close, that wind can start picking up. So once you're off the ground and once you're at height, 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and in fact, you're limited in height only as high as you can breathe, and even then you can put oxygen and go higher. However, once you're off the ground, the wind speed doesn't matter to you very much, okay? You can be doing 24, 25, 30 knots even, and the wind speed does not affect you. It's when you bring that balloon back down onto the ground is where wind speed matters a lot. So some of my more exciting flights, I kind of use the term sport flights, involve wind. And winds have picked up on us, and we've made landings in some substantial wind, and things get a little challenging would be a word, a little close, because we all end up rolled up in a ball in the basket after a drag landing. I tend to avoid those kind of sport flights as best as I can nowadays, though. As I mentioned earlier there, I've been flying for over 30 years, so I've kind of got that part down. A few things, though. I've been towed to shore by a boat, because we have exactly the opposite from what I was saying there. We got calmed, and so we were trying, actually it was just up in Barrie, Ontario, we were making a Kempenfelt Bay crossing, and the wind died off about 100 to 200 feet away from shore. And luckily, as luck would have it, a boat was coming by, and we got towed to shore. Very interesting little thing. One little hiccup in that problem arose was when we threw down the handling line. I just realized as the line went out of my hand that perhaps the boat driver should be aware that the line could get caught in the engine. And guess what? Got wrapped around the prop. The guy had to jump into the water, unhook the balloon, and it's getting dark. I don't want to lose him. He got us right to shore, nice, safe, and sound. But there was a little bit of adventure involved in that by the time we were all said and done.
Wow. So you have had, you know, I guess close calls, if you want to call it that, in the 30 years you've been doing this. And I wanted to ask you, how did you actually get involved in ballooning?
In 77, I was actually making a decision. I was looking to buy a sailboat. And there was a magazine, and you know, I don't believe it's being sold anymore, but I still have the copy of it. It was a magazine called Omni Magazine way back. It was science fiction short stories, and I was kind of reading that magazine then. And they had this big spread in the magazine of one of the biggest balloon festivals in the world called Albuquerque Balloon Festival. That festival, usually they have anywhere between 700 to 800 balloons attending during their event. Anyways, there was a pictorial in there, and it was just, I knew it. I saw that, and I knew that's what I wanted. In fact, I mentioned a little earlier there, I actually bought a balloon before I'd ever even been in one. That's how sure I was. I guess a little
that's awesome,
a little more
Ken.
Than what people would normally do, but I'd made up my mind just from the picture.
Well, that's good. And sometimes, you know, my dad always tells me to follow your gut, so obviously that's what you've done, and it's worked out for you. And something I'd actually heard about, and I wanted you to tell me if it's true or not, is it true that balloon pilots, you know, have a ritual that they do after they land, and it's been something that's been done for hundreds of years?
There is. We have a champagne toast, but I'll tell you, there's all sorts of permutations of this up on the end where we meet up with the landowner, and we celebrate our balloon flight, cheers to the landowner for the ground, and celebrate with the new wings on board, people who haven't flown before, and, you know, happy that the crew have shown up right on time. I have stood in a field for over 4 hours waiting for crew before, but that's another story. And
Mm-hmm.
So we celebrate way back when balloons first started to happen, the Montgolfier days. We're talking late 1700s. The farmers thought the balloons were devils. And the whole point of the champagne toast was the landowner or the farmers at the time would see the champagne and then think, you know what, they can't be devils, or they're drinking champagne. This is just wonderful. So that's how that tradition started, and basically it's been carried on for centuries now.
Wow, that's fantastic. And, you know, we have been talking about how ballooning could be a really great gift, whether it's for, you know, Father's Day, which is coming up, or, you know, for someone else's birthday or Mother's Day, you know, all that kind of good stuff. What type of feedback do you get, Ken, after you take, you know, a newbie up there?
Well, I'll tell you, one of our marketing things, if you will, is word of mouth. We look for that, and wow. That would be the word that most people would use, okay? They're comforted by the personable discussion with the crew and the pilot. Some humor is involved, but for most part, people are just basically happy. I tell most people my goal is not to fly the farthest or the highest or the longest. My goal is to fly, land, and want to do it again. And as long as that continues, that's, I think the flight is 100% successful.
That's a great, you know, outlook or mantra to have. That's amazing. I think a lot of people should apply that to other parts of their life as well. And something as well for people, you know, who are listening to this from all over the world, Ken, is this definitely a worldwide sport, hot air ballooning?
It most certainly is. You can find balloons everywhere, from some of the Africa, Turkey, Europe. It's a huge sport in Europe, Switzerland, and Sweden, very big. In fact, Sweden has some of the hugest balloons, what we would refer to as 400 series balloons, 24, 30 type numbers of people on board these great big buses, if you will. And in the Americas, the United States, there are probably more balloon festivals down in the United States than there are days of the year, which is something we didn't talk that much, but there are balloon festivals all over the world, and that's where balloonists all get together and, well, fly. Near the Montreal area, I believe St. John Richelieu, at the festival that I've been attending for about 25 years, regularly has 130 balloons attend at a festival, and it is just a fabulous event with the camaraderie and thousands of people out there as all the balloons take off. And we have these festivals spotted all over the place, U.S., Canada, Europe, Philippines, and down under as well, with Australia and New Zealand, all over. And I believe Russia has a few events that are starting up, and there's a couple of fabulous ones even in Italy as well.
That's amazing. And if someone wants to get into ballooning, Ken, because again, you know, it sounds like such a really peaceful and an awesome sport to get involved in, what would you suggest for that if someone, you know, is really passionate about trying this out?
Well, they've got my website there. They can definitely drop a line. The main thing that one has to remember with sport ballooning in particular is it's not like an airplane. So if you want to learn how to fly, part of your decisions have to be made as what you're going to do for an aircraft. So they're not balloons are not near as expensive as an airplane would be. So, but they are not available to rent. So, you know what, an entry-level balloon, brand spanking new, something you could be proud of, will run somebody around $30,000 these days. So that's something that they need to be mindful of if they were to want to pursue flying hot air balloons. Now, obviously, there's used equipment out there, but that's where I'd be aimed.
Perfect. Well, Ken, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Kelly.
That's Ken Rowland again, owner of Toronto Balloon Tours, and you can check out his website, airdisplay.ca.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's very easy to get caught up in keeping a lot of stuff in your home that you don't need. Sometimes it's because you have a sentimental attachment to it, and sometimes it's because you think you might use it later on down the road, so you just store it and forget about it. But over time, the stuff keeps piling up and you run out of room. To help us get a handle on how to keep our homes clutter-free and also use some of the old treasures we've been keeping is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, A Back-to-Basics Guide to a More Balanced Lifestyle, Christine Eisner. Christine, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Christine, why does it seem that so many of us have a problem making a decision about getting rid of stuff and then it ends up piling up?
You know, I think because we're looking for a connection, we're looking to attach to ourselves to something that feels like home. And I think it's as simple as that. People crave home. We want to be, we want to have our feet solidly on the ground. And sometimes instead of really focusing on what's in our heart, we start to attach to things that really end up not being relevant at all to our lives. And they end up really becoming huge obstacles to our quality of life and well-being.
Now, is decluttering, and I think a term you use is streamlining, is it, you know, does it end up being a way of life?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is basically a rhythm that you work in. And I, yes, I use the word streamlining because for me, decluttering means taking stuff away. And that's half the equation. Really, the more important half is to bring into your life your what I call your treasures. You know, you want to turn down the volume on the things that get in the way of your life, but then you end up potentially with an empty house. So it's just as important, if not more important, to bring into your life and make more prominent in your life the things that really feed you, the things that really resonate with you. So that's why, you know, decluttering is a key part because you can become choked. I mean, many of us are just, you know, it's not just hoarders. It's all of us that have things in our life that no longer speak to us. So streamlining, I think, is a really, really important process. And it is that kind of thing where you do on a regular basis. You know, when you buy three new pieces of clothing or a new set of placemats, you know, you look at that old set. You look at, do I need these old ones? You know, instead of just putting the new placemats on top of the old ones. Or I have a system that I use and that I encourage people to use to sort of be a gatekeeper in your closet. You know, if three things are coming into your closet, then maybe five things leave.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, just about how you you tackle, I guess, these overstuffed homes, because I think a lot of people don't want to even start or know where to start because they feel so overwhelmed. They think, you know, every room has something that they're not sure how to deal with it.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is to just start small. If you look at, you know, the Cat in the Hat is a great example of decluttering because there's this huge mess and it's so big and, you know, you can't even approach it. But if you just start with a drawer or a closet, I think that's very helpful. Don't look at it as the huge job. But I sort of break it down into four ways of thinking about it. You know, things that you can store or put away, things that you can give away, things that you can sell, whether it's in an estate sale or whatever, and things that you literally throw away or ideally recycle. You know, if you have like an area, of, whether it's a drawer or a closet or a bag that you literally, as clothes, you know, as your kids' clothes become too small for them, you know, you know, are you going to give it away? Are you going to store it for, you know, for their children? Are you going to sell it in an estate sale or, you know, however, in a consignment store or whatever? Or is it just you're going to donate it or are you going to get rid of it because it's just lived its life? And I think if you sort of look at it in four little compartments, four chutes that they can go down, then it becomes a little easier. I also think that if you are not sure about something, if you store it, if you put it, you know, you don't have to have everything in your home visible to you because then it's really overload. A gradual step for someone who is overwhelmed is, okay, if you don't think you're ready to part with something, put it in a cabinet, put it in a closet, and then go back. This is where the rhythm of streamlining comes in. Go back and revisit that closet and then make the decision. But, you know, first to just get it out of your visual, your day-to-day space, that's a great first step.
Now, what about stuff you can't throw away, like family heirlooms or antique furniture? Is there a way to make this stuff usable in your daily life, or does it have to be stored because, you know, maybe it can get broken?
No, I think that you can... You know, you can take things that are family heirlooms out of your life. You know, that's where giving them, you know, maybe there's another family member that wants something. Maybe you do sell it. Maybe if you have a silver service that you really aren't going to use anymore, maybe you keep one teaspoon as an echo, as a bridge to the bigger memory, and then you do sell the rest or give away the rest. So, you know, sometimes we think we can't get rid of something, but if that's the case, if that's the only reason you're hanging on to something, then I would say, you know, maybe it's time to question what you really can do and think creatively. I mean, also, you know, a silver service to a senior community where, you know, where maybe your grandmother was before she passed away, to put that there, you know, then you're putting this wonderful energy into it, and it feels good to pass it on. So I think, you know, that's one thing. But the other thing is sometimes you can also, you know, repurpose something. For instance, a Victorian sideboard, and I say this, this was not in my family, but it was an antique piece, and I thought it was really neat and wonderful. I actually took it, it was dark wood, I spray painted it, God forbid, silver, and put on new knobs, and now it is in my mid-century modern dining room. So, you know, I think sometimes if you hang on to something just because you're supposed to, well, I don't believe in supposed to. I believe in, you know, if you want it to be part of your life, make it part of your life. You really aren't going to make a ton of money selling it, so it's okay to paint over whatever it might be, or to, you know, turn a vase into a lamp. And go for it.
Joining us on the show is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, Christine Eisner. Make sure to check out her website, comfortlivingbychristine.com. Christine, once you have, I guess, pared down and your home can breathe, how do you maintain this balanced lifestyle? Because maybe it would be easy to start filling it up again.
Absolutely. It's like, you know, the bigger the closet you have, the fuller, the more stuff you'll have to put in it. I think it's really, really important to just be vigilant and literally make a routine of when your house is clean, that's really the best time to go and look around and say, you know, what do I really need? Or do I really want this here? Or everybody who has a garage or a cellar probably has a pile of flower pots that are, you know, those clay flower pots that are unused, and they're just waiting because the plants died in them before, and they're just waiting to have something done with them. If you re-energize things that you already have, then they'll take on a different role in your life. So, you know, take those flower pots and go and plant some mint in them. You know, now that the weather's happening, you know, for now that Memorial Day's happened and we're coming into summer, plant some mint, and then you can be making mint tea, you can be making mojitos or tabbouleh, and all of a sudden that pile of empty flower pots becomes a part of your life that is totally different than what they were when they were sitting in that dark corner gathering dust and cobwebs.
Okay. And when you are in the process, I guess, of getting rid of things, should you actually think about hosting a garage sale, or is that something, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's something you should really think about, or just, you know, pass the things off to other people or get rid of them?
Well, I think garage sales are a great way to get rid of things in a way that makes you feel good about getting rid of them. You know, the process of getting ready for one, you know, you already are looking at what might you pass on, or what might you give away. Usually what's left over, you know, is a great mindset not to take it back into your house, but to say, you know what, I'm just going to donate this right away to, you know, whatever organization you like that sings to you. But one way to make that maybe feel better is have, before the garage sale starts, you know, say on Friday, say that morning or the night before, you know, have your family and friends over and say, you know what, guys, just choose. Or, you know, that way it's all out there ready to go. And if there are certain things that you're like, well, you know, I was thinking that maybe you might like this and this and this, you know, you can choose to give it to them at that point. Or you can just choose to sell it to them early. And that way you know also that it's going into the hands of, you know, of people that you know. But I think it's a good incentive because it's a big project. It gets underway. There are experts who, their professions are doing garage sales. You can use them or you can do it yourself. But I think it's a great way to pay it forward because everybody benefits. You get rid of your stuff. The people that buy it for, you know, just great prices, and then they bring it into to re-energize their homes, which in turn makes their homes a better place to live for them. So it's a whole, you know, it's like a whole process that just keeps moving everybody forward in life.
Now, speaking of, you know, these garage sales, should you, or I guess for people who go out to these events, how do you keep yourself in check, especially if you do have a tendency to want to buy a lot of stuff because, you know, you view it as a good deal?
Well, I think it's great to sort of go with to walk through your home beforehand and just sort of think about the kinds of things you might want. Like, you know, do you need would a rug? Rugs are great bargains at garage sales. You know, could you use a rug for the den? And if so, maybe take some measurements so that you're not buying a rug that's the wrong size. Could you use some lamps? Could you use a, you know, could your kids use a winter coat or whatever? Kids' clothes are a great bargain also. And come with a little bit of a list, because otherwise you might get overloaded on stuff. But the other thing is, you know, a lot of times the parking for garage sales, you know, you have to walk down the road a little bit. So that's a good preventer as well, because if you know that you have to carry that stuff back, then maybe that'll keep you in check too. But again, I think it's this gatekeeper thing. You know, if you're going to buy something, you think about if I'm buying that den rug, then I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to be getting rid of the one that already exists, or, you know, what can come out of my house before I bring something in. And that's, I think, a really easy and great way to keep yourself in check.
Should you also bring someone with you if you know that you have this tendency to get, you know, super amped and like, oh, I like this and I like that? Like, should you bring someone with you who might also help keep yourself in check, whether it's your spouse or a great friend?
Like a reverse enabler.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea. But I think also you need to let them know why you want them there, because sometimes someone is like, oh, that dress looks great on you or whatever. And, you know, you want to let them know that you have this tendency and, you know, that here's your list. I'd share the list with them and say, you know, okay, let, you know what my goals are in wanting you to come with. But, you know, the other thing is it's just fun to have someone with you. So.
And when you are at these garage sales, is it, you know, important that you really sort of have a good eye or get a good eye about, you know, really what's junk and what isn't? Because I think for some people, I know a lot of people really love garage sales and it's like their thing, and you can find things that, you know, you might have paid $300 for and you're getting it for, you know, $75. So I see the value in it. But then I see some people, or I've seen things on television where people get caught up in these trinkets and all this kind of stuff, and basically they're just bringing back more junk to their own home.
Yes, and I think that definitely a temptation. I think you just have to really think, do I need this? Is this going to, William Morris, the arts and crafts movement visionary, he had a great quote. He says, have nothing in your life that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. So that deals with function. Is it really going to, do you need it? You know, do you need that lounge chair? Or is it really beautiful? Is looking at it going to just make your day wonderful? And if it doesn't fit in one of those two categories, then I would say pass. Definitely pass, because otherwise, yes, you can very easily get yourself into a situation where you're totally entangled in your own stuff. And that, I think, is the cause of a lot of discomfort living. My book is called Comfort Living. You know, people are very, very uncomfortable in their own lives. And, you know, and when that happens, a lot of times it is because their treasures are so buried underneath all the other junk in their life. And I mean objects as well as, you know, could be relationships or whatever. And you just need to get out from it and streamline to really get clear on the things that are most important to you.
Now, Christine, I wanted your opinion on this. I think, you know, the prevailing saying is that, you know, opposites attract. So with regards to relationships and couples living together, I think there are people that, you know, maybe one might be super anal about keeping a clean home and the other guy's, you know, a bit messy. And, you know, there's all those sorts of comparisons. But when it comes down to someone who likes a streamlined home with maybe someone who likes to go to these garage sales and pick up stuff, I see that this could be a real bone of contention. So what do you say to couples who might be, you know, on opposite sides of the spectrum?
Well, I think, again, you know, that list is important. What would be good things to buy? You know, maybe some outdoor furniture. I'm in this very summer mode right now. But, you know, maybe outdoor furniture would be a good thing to buy. So that person who is more the tidy, the neat freak, you know, maybe they can make some suggestions about what would be good things to look for, so that the other person can, you know, sort of follow their passion. But at the same time, the person who is the acquirer, they really need to respect what their partner wants. There's a great exercise on page 16 of my book, which is about, it's really simple exercise, and there's actually a download of it on my website. But it's just a matter of circling words of how you want to feel in your home. And believe it or not, that helps so many couples and families be able to understand where the other's coming from. So if, you know, if your words might be, you know, neat and spare and comfortable, and mine might be eclectic and, interesting and comfortable, then, you know, you sort of find that comfortable word as a common word. And when I see that neat, and you sort of boil down to what are the three most important words, when I see that neat and spare are two of three words in my partner, then I'm going to really, it's almost gifting them by not overloading them. So if you have that awareness of where the person, what the person really wants to feel when they're in their home and in their comfort zone, I think it makes it easier to respect where they're coming from instead of just saying, you know, just having your own perspective on how you want to feel in your home.
And I guess, you know, what is your main piece of advice when it comes to trying to get a handle on your clutter and you know, keeping, I guess, that really key phrase or that key word, you know, in the forefront of your mind, which is streamlining?
Yeah, I think it's make a habit of streamlining. It is not a once-in-a-lifetime task. It's not even a once-a-year task. I would say it's at least quarterly. So streamline quarterly, and as you do it, think about making room for your treasures. So get rid of the obstacles or reduce the volume of your obstacles so your treasures can really shine in your life.
Fantastic. And Christine, where do people get a copy of your book?
You can get a copy on Amazon, of course, and also on my website. I also have a comfort living journal, which is specifically about helping people focus on their treasures and obstacles. So that's something, it's like a companion guide. It's a little thing that you can carry with you. You can actually even put your yard sale list in the book, and then it sort of helps you really, really focus on exactly what we've been talking about.
Fantastic. Christine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's always good to talk to you.
That's lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, Christine Eisner. Make sure to check out her website, www.comfortlivingbychristine.com.
Capture your need for sound.
If you have a pet, you know how important they are to the family. It's like having another child running around. And it's important to treat your furry kid as best you can. And that includes proper medical care. Our next guest can help you do that, even if you're on a budget. Dr. Robert Ridgway is a veterinarian and author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. Dr. Ridgway, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Perfect. Now, Dr. Ridgway, why did you actually write this book, you know, Treating Animals with Over-the-Counter Drugs? I think maybe for some people that might seem maybe scary or negligent to some people,
yeah,
thinking that they wouldn't go see a veterinarian.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the thing that I do in the book is to encourage everybody, number one, to go see the veterinarian. But the problem I have learned is that there are two groups of people. Number one, there are folks who are never going to take their pet to see a veterinarian. I don't care how traumatic or how bad the pet is, they will not take their pet to see a veterinarian. Secondly, I have friends who would like to take their pet to see a veterinarian, but they just cannot afford to do so. So they're not going to go either. And the third reason I wrote the book is that I know that people are using over-the-counter drugs to treat their pets. And I looked up one of the toxicology websites, and I found that several hundred animals had been treated with ivermectin, and that either killed their pet or made it very, very sick. And there are other compounds that people are buying over-the-counter and treating their pets with, and they don't know the dose to give or how long to give it. And so I thought that I could help people that I felt that had kind of been ignored by my profession, because it's not a profitable circumstances for them to do so. Does that make sense?
It definitely makes sense. And I wanted to ask you if you could explain to us about the book itself and how it works.
So the way the book works is that at the beginning of each chapter, there's, of course, it tells you what's in that particular chapter. But, for example, the topic, like cleaning ears, then it gives you how to do that and what you need to do. And or dogs fetching balls and the treatment and what you need to do if a ball gets stuck in the throat, you know. And so what we do is explain what the situation is, and then how you can treat it. And if there's a medication, it gives the dose, daily dose, how many days to give, and where you can go to purchase that product.
Wow, that's fantastic. I think that's amazing. That really is sort of laying everything out step by step for everyone. And I guess, you know, is there a lot of ailments that can actually be treated, Dr. Ridgway, by over-the-counter drugs, you know, for these cats and dogs?
Well, you know, I have 103 items in book number one, which is called How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. And I have 63 in How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs Companion Edition. So that's, 166 different things that either can be treated or prevented if you read the book and know what to do and how to do it. And so if you prevent it, you don't have the expense of medication. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, what are some of the most common diseases, you know, in dogs and cats, and what are the symptoms to be on the lookout for?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question because it can be a lot of things, and every person will probably give you a different answer. However, let's start by just having dirty ears can result in an infection of the ears and head tilt. And so the idea here is to, you know, you just need to look at the ears and make sure that they're clean. And normally to determine that they're dirty, you can see some black stuff in the ear. And if you see that, then there's probably some gunk in there or some ear mites. And if that's ignored, you can have a ear infection, and then you have to have medication. It may result in a real need to see your pet's doctor. But if you're on top of it, you keep the ears clean. I tell you how to clean the ears in the book. And so it's super simple, and it's things that you can purchase right over the counter at a grocery store or Walmart or at a pharmacy, and it's very easy to do. Eyes, sometimes, you know, dogs get dry eyes, and all you need to do is put artificial tears in the eye. But I have seen so many dry eyes that nobody, that people have not made an effort to do anything, that I felt like I need to write about this, because you can go to the pharmacy, Walmart, grocery stores, and find artificial tears and put in the eyes, and the eyes will clear up instead of being cloudy and having all that gunk around the eyes, and they just look really nice. Now, there are other things that cause eye problems other than dry eyes. Well, you can tell dry eyes normally because, you know, the eye is kind of dry and you get all this gunk around the eye. And the thing that's spooky about eyes, it's really easy to have an eye today and it's gone tomorrow. And so if you put artificial tears in the eye and it doesn't clear up right away, they need to see the pet's doctor to make darn sure that they're doing the right thing. I had a fellow call me from Oklahoma. And he went to a veterinarian, and they diagnosed a fungal condition. And so he treated the fungal condition according to the book. And he called me and told me what he was doing. He was really excited about the book and how it was, you know, the disease was resolving. And, it's a pleasure to get stuff like that. Now, toenail trimming. A lot of people will trim their pet's toenails, and they cut them too short, and they start bleeding. And if they use some cornstarch, they can stop the bleeding. You know, if you just prepare before you clip the toenails, have your cornstarch available because you're probably going to clip it, then it's real easy. I've had one person tell me, he says, my gosh, I clipped the dog's toenails and it bled all over the kitchen. He didn't know what to do. Another one, people are trying to be kind to their pet and they're feeding an all-meat diet. But the problem with an all-meat diet is the calcium-phosphorus ratio is way off. It should be 1 to 1.1, 1.2 phosphorus to calcium. But when you use an all-meat diet, you have a high phosphorus and a low calcium. And the body will maintain the blood calcium level. And if you were going to guess, where does an animal or a person have calcium that he can mobilize to keep the blood calcium level normal? And you have to think, oh, the bones. And so the next thing you know, the bones are paper thin, and they start breaking. And people wonder, how is my dog? He didn't get hit, but he's got broken bones. The other thing that they develop a dandruff, and called pityriasis, and you have all this flaking of the skin, and oftentimes they have diarrhea. And Mark M. Morris Jr. found that if he fed an all meat diet for 3 months, it would kill a dog.
Wow.
And so it's important that you, people think about cereals and so forth and feeds. Now, the thing is, this was back in the early 70s, And the FDA has gotten more. The Food and Drug Administration's got more into pet foods, has found out in snowstorms and stuff like that. People are eating these dog foods. So they got more involved in this, and there's more of a cognate of providing a proper diet for our pets now due to that, you know. I can go on here. Petting-induced aggression in cats. You can start petting a cat, and all this, and if you pet it, and it'll bite you. And that's called petting-induced aggression in cats, and really all you got to do is just pet the cat a little bit and then stop, leave it alone, and you won't get bit. But if when your friends come over, you tell them, don't pet the cat. Guess what they're going to do? They're going to pet the cat until they get bit.
Yes, that's true. And I wanted to ask you as well, you know, speaking of cats and dogs, and something that I think happens to a lot of dogs particularly is if they get sprayed by a skunk. How would you deal with that, Dr. Ridgway?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They had a chemist come up with the materials for this, and it's rather simple. What you do, you just need a clean bucket or a large bowl, and then you mix in the bottle, a small container, because the ingredients are very active, and you add 1 quart of hydrogen peroxide to 1 quart of water, and you add 1/4 cup of Arm & Hammer baking soda, and a teaspoon, 1 or 2 teaspoons of any liquid soap, and you mix it with a plastic utensil. You protect the eyes of the dogs. You can put some ointment in it, artificial tears or whatever, or put your hand over it. And I would suggest that you use rubber gloves or something like that for yourself, and you just pour it on the animal, and that'll help the smell tremendously. I guess you have a lot of skunks up there in Canada.
Yeah, well, they seem to be all over the place in general. And I know when I lived in Toronto, there was some there as well. So I think it's probably a North American issue to deal with. Joining us on the show is veterinarian Dr. Robert Ridgway, author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. Dr. Ridgway, how important is it to recognize the signs that your pet may need professional help and not to play doctor yourself?
I think it's most important. I say in the book that the number one thing, the best thing to do, is always to take the pet to the veterinarian, because they're trained to make a diagnosis, and they know what to treat. And what's, for example, we were talking about eyes earlier. One of the things that can happen in a pet is that, you know, the third eyelid comes across the eye. It can get a foreign body behind there, and you can try and get it out by flushing it or whatever, but that isn't very effective. And if you take it to your veterinarian, he or she can put some medication in the eye, and almost instantly the pain will be gone and will allow them to lift the third eyelid and get that foreign body out of there. And if you leave it there, the foreign body will move back and forth on the eye and cause an ulcer on the cornea of the eye, and you certainly don't want that. So that's a prime example. And the ideal thing is always, always, always to go see the veterinarian. But my problem I found is that people don't go, and they're not going to go. And so that's the reason I wrote the book.
And with regards to dosage, Dr. Ridgway, how important is it for people to follow, you know, these dosing instructions that are in your book? Because I think sometimes people think, oh, a bit more of this and maybe a little less of that doesn't really matter.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. And I mentioned that in the foreword of the book, where people think if a little bit is good, a whole bunch ought to be better. And that's how you kill your pet or make it really, really sick. Now, I was super concerned about people overdosing their pets and calculating dosages. So what I did, I made charts so that you look at the chart and determine the weight of your dog. And all you have to do is look at the weight of the dog and go across the chart and get the dose that you need to give for, let's say, an internal parasite or something like that, or an external parasite. It made a difference. And it's super simple. All you got to do is know weight in pounds, and it says dose in cc's. I'm looking at the chart right here in front of me. Give me a weight. Here's a 9.8, a 69-pound dog that needs a dose of 13.8 cc's. I mean, it's just that simple. All you got to do is just know the weight of the dog, look at the chart, and that's it. Because I was super concerned that people would make a mistake in calculating, so I made these charts so there's not going to be any mistake. And if you give the dose that I give in the book, even if you misdiagnose it, you're not going to harm the pet. if you use the proper dose. You overdose it or underdose. See, the other thing is that nobody can be there when you or anybody else tries to treat their pet. It is their decision right on the spot to do whatever it is that they're going to do. And you or I have no control over what they do. But if they follow this guide in the book, they're going to be okay. They're not going to have a problem.
Dr. Ridgway, where can people get a copy of this book?
Well, they can get a copy of this book in many places. Amazon.com is probably the most common.
That's fantastic, Dr. Ridgway. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
That's quite all right. My pleasure. Anytime.
Excellent. That is veterinarian Dr. Robert Ridgway, author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. And again, check it out on Amazon.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. And as always, a big thank you going out to my guests, Ken Rowland, Christine Eisner, and Dr. Robert Ridgway. Now, on next week's show, we chat with best-selling author and behavior expert Beverly Flaxington about how to better manage your relationships at home and at work. It's very important to get along not only with your spouse, but also with your coworkers. Now, don't forget to check out our new Twitter feed that we've just launched a couple of weeks ago. It's K Alexander Show. Make sure to check it out on Twitter. Again, you can always check out our Facebook page as well, Kelly Alexander Show. And don't forget our website, www.kellyalexandershow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.